What's happening?
All right, starting again. Okay, yeah. So, welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, part of the Rhetoric Warriors project. RhetoricWarriors.com, Tom. Yeah, let me sort of run what's going on here and we'll get ourselves oriented. The Rhetoric Warriors is a, I don't know.
I love that name, Rhetoric Warriors. It's kind of a cool, it's cool phrasing.
Yeah, trying to get, you know, trying to get into people's, into their grill a little bit.
Yeah.
With some persuasion ideas. Yeah, the thing is, it's we're out to teach America to persuade America. Persuasion's kind of broken down these days. People don't know what to do. We're getting persuaded in very unethical ways. Nobody really knows how to fight back or cancel those things. And my background, right, you know, in rhetoric, that's what my PhD is in. So this is a way for me to try to get some of that information out to the world.
Do you think that once people understand how to do it, they will, or they'll start to recognize when they are and when they're not? And I mean, is that part of what you learn when you first studied it, or is it something you really have to commit to be in?
I'm going to answer that in 1 second. Let me introduce Tom Simmons to everybody.
Okay. Sorry.
Tom Simmons, I've known for a long time, probably 20 years.
Yes.
At least.
Yes. Back when you were doing stand-up, and then you got out. I don't know if you're back in.
I wander through stand-up back and forth. Tom is a long-time stand-up, like an avowed stand-up, right? That's what you are.
Yes. Yes. I remember a couple times early in my career, like manager types and show business types being like, so what do you want to be? And I'm like, I just want to be a comedian. And they, especially back then, they did not want it. You could just watch them go, all right.
Yeah, yeah. They didn't have any idea what to do with that. How do I make money with a stand-up?
Yes. Yes. And they were wrong. They, you know, but.
Yeah, they were wrong, but they were right.
Yes, yes, yes.
So Tom's a long time stand-up comic, lives in Greensboro, North Carolina. So you're like Heartland. You're a Heartland comic, right?
Yeah, I guess. You know what? I don't really, when you say Heartland, I honestly don't know what that, I feel like that means like Wisconsin, Michigan. You know what I mean? That, to me, that's like Heartland, Ohio.
Southern, like the South, the Midwest. Like you've worked.
Yeah.
That's what I do. Circuit. East.
Yes. I'm a road guy. I lived in a motorhome for years. You know, it's interesting, you know, and when you say rhetoric, the art of sort of talking to people and convincing people of things. And I think comedy is that.
It is exactly that.
You know, some of the best comics that I've always admired in my life, they've from an early age opened my mind and changed the way I see and think about things, you know. I've maybe given them too much credit, to be honest. Like, oh, well, they wouldn't say that if it wasn't fact. Now I realize, well, they're just going to say whatever they can to get a laugh.
Sure. A little stretch in there to get your laughs.
But some of it is the most convincing argument that I, in my life, how it works in my brain. Like if you can make me laugh at myself and what I'm saying, or make your point through a crisp joke.
Yeah. Ooh. That brings those two worlds crashing together, right? You get some pleasure, yeah, you know, from the idea and the new, you know, solution to something or perspective, and you get the art of the, you know, joke right there told well.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a sweet moment. Yeah. And so rhetoric, yeah, is really the study of any effective messaging. Like everybody thinks of it as argument and logic, debate, or empty political talk. But it's really the study of how do you speak effectively when you're trying to accomplish something? So comedy is exactly that. You're trying to do things to the audience and you create, you know, rhetorical structures within stand-up to make that happen.
Wow. And you realize you're doing it when you're doing it, like because you studied it, and then the rest of us just sort of fluke into that through the way we write.
You know, I lift it out. Like that's, I think the real difference is when you intellectualize this stuff, you lift it out, you look for patterns, you see if you can, you know, describe it and then maybe teach it back or at least, you know, write a paper about it. But there's intuitive rhetoricians all over the place. where you intuitively learn these things, not in a formal way, but an informal, experiential way.
Okay.
And I see guys like you, incredibly artful. And one of the things I've really liked about you watching your career is that you like topics. You like actual issues.
Yes. Yes. And people have tended to lump me as a political comic, right?
He's a
political comic. Yeah, you wouldn't, because you pay attention to words. You know what I mean? But that's sort of been what I've been categorized. In the meantime, I'm not political. Like, you know, friends of mine, like Jimmy Dore, Danny Bevins, or, you know what I mean? Those to me are political guys. They can tell you who their senator is.
Right.
Not that I can, but you know what I mean? They
yeah, Danny, for sure.
Danny used to DVR fucking C-SPAN. You know what I mean? So to me, I'm like the issue kind of strikes me, you know?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, that split that people, you know, politics is paying attention to actual politicians and to government, and social issues, intellectual issues. You can be just, they work the same grounds, but you don't care about the politicians who are doing it. You care about the ideas that are within it.
Right. So, or unless the politicians are pissing me off because they specifically work against, you know, what I feel like is the right side of an issue, you know?
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's politics. Politics always has 2 sides, 10 sides, 50 sides to every issue. And therefore it doesn't care about the issue. It cares about winning the issue or using the issue to, you know, further its side, which probably drives guys right. like you crazy, because you like the best idea, I think.
Yes. Yes. I think so. I mean, I would like to think that, you know, I would like to think that I'm like, oh, if you can beat me with the idea, then I'm going to buy it. But that's not always the case. Maybe it takes years to sink in, you know. For years, I was a conspiracy guy, you know, after 9/11, because of Kennedy and because of, you know, other things in my life, I was like, I sort of got into that stuff early, you know, and I was like, man, there's only 2,000 views on this. How does the whole world not know that it was an inside job, you know? And I'm sure now it's been, but now as the years go on, it's like, oh, I see how, not that I don't think there's still a lot of questions, or maybe even think, but I don't dive into the next one, if that makes sense. You know, like as the conspiracies have sort of built on each other, now I feel like they're all, you know, a little out
you
there.
You got conspiracy exhaustion.
Yeah, they discredit my true shit.
My true myths are somehow being lumped in with all this false conspiracy yes. stuff.
It's all part of the plan to hide my thing in the midst of a bunch of bullshit. So that everybody can dismiss my thing.
Do you have a bit that you like about the conspiracy stuff that you ever talk about?
I actually
I'd love for you to just throw out, if I trigger anything, just throw out a bit, because this is it's partly to teach. It's partly, especially when I have comedians on, you know, throw some entertainment in there. It's all good.
Right. No, no, not really. I mean, I guess it's interesting because since COVID I've all this time off, I've decided to take advantage of it and to throw all my older stuff out.
Okay.
You know what I mean? And I've done it for years, you know, and not that it's going to be, if I start working again and I need to go do a week on a cruise ship and you got to do 5 different shows, believe me, I'm looking back and getting that stuff.
Sure.
But I'm sort of having fun sort of starting over and picking new issues and trying to tackle them, and, you know, so yeah, it's like, when I'm trying to think of a conspiracy bit I have, and the closest I think I have to one is my older Federal Reserve Bank joke, which is a chunk on the Fed, which now I don't even feel it's just feels like I'm telling this thing again, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that was sort of one of the first ones that I really was like, money's not real and it's owned by a few people like that won't give us their name. Like, that was crazy to me. So I really dove into that and tried to figure out, how do I get this across? And I really
broke going through the chart. Architecture of that bit. We talked a little bit somewhere in the middle of you.
Yeah, you helped me with it. I think you helped me write. And it's the same thing that happens. It's like somebody else helped. It's like, oh, I like this. And you helped me. You wrote a bunch on it. And it's just like everything, like a line or two jumps out. I'm like, oh, okay, you know. Yes.
Well, that's the beauty of stand-up, right? It's so picky. Picky. You can only use the top of the, you know, the cream of the 1% of the jokes, because once you write a few of those, you can't throw a bunch of junk in after them.
Right. That's why I got to get rid of all. That was my hard time continuing to replace. It's hard to write a new joke that's better than the one, the best of all the jokes you've written for 20 years. Like, it's hard for something to, you know, to be better than that.
Yeah, although for sure.
Every notebook I write. Yeah.
I mean, I started stand up in 1987, you know, 35 or 30, 33 years ago. Something like
right.
That. Whatever. Long it is.
That's, yeah.
And, you know, I have jokes that I did within the first month that would still work.
Right.
It would still work. 33-year-old joke.
Yeah. What's cool, what's interesting in comedy is, you know, like if you write topical and you write issue topical, it's in the consciousness every, like for a couple months, every 8 months, every, maybe it's 2 years before Israel and Palestine are fighting again. Maybe right. It's, you know what I mean? Maybe it's yeah, 6 months before a cop shoots an innocent person. Yes. Right. So as long as if you have it, you can write the new one and then have the old five that fits with it. You know, a hurricane's always coming and wiping out some right. place, you know? So it's over time. It's like, it can be topical. And like you said, 33 years old, every time somebody shoots someone and shoots a bunch of people and then kills themselves, I'm like, thank God my bit about the, you know,
right.
About how we should have a suicide talk them into a hotline that they can call in first. You know what I mean? Like that,
that
joke
it.
Has been
Bullhorns.
New for
Do it.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, it's so funny. And once you start, yeah, you know, rolling through those topics, that's like with me, I've been writing jokes for so long. Like you just said, Israel, Palestine. And I wrote a Dennis Miller joke years ago when I was on that show. And it was Israel and Palestine, like the fashion industry was trying to do some bridge building. So they had, right. They built a runway and did a modeling session at the wall, you know? And it's like, well, yeah. The nice thing about that is that they're so skinny that only the most accurate Palestinians can hit them with a rock.
Right.
You know? And it's just endless. Like all that stuff recycles yes. And you have lines. You're like, oh yeah, I can say that again.
Yep. And the argument's always the same. There's always a white girl missing. There's always, so they always circle back around. It's like healthcare is always an issue. The climate is always an issue. Like all these things are always, they always come back an issue.
Because we now, never solve them, right? We never solve yes. those issues.
No.
Why would we? Comedians wouldn't have anything to talk about. All the material you would lose if we had an efficient government.
Right. Hey, when you were writing for Dennis Miller, was that back when he was Bill Maher or back or after he sort of flipped and became the conservative?
He was falling out of the system at that point. So I was at CNBC. So it was after his HBO show. And it seems like there may even have been another show in between that. But he had flipped over to the right, the extreme right. And so like the show, the writing staff was all mostly the same staff he had at HBO.
Like so, David you know, Feldman and you, David Feldman and you, and like yes,
yeah, Jim Hanna and Bob Oshak and a lot of these guys, good hardcore regular dudes, liberals. The whole staff was liberal,
right?
You know, and you just write your jokes, and then Dennis would add in, you know, the venom,
right? Now I, you know, it's funny because I don't know how you would describe Dennis, but I'd never met him, right? And I knew him. As that, where I was like, oh, he's hilarious. And then I sort of, after 9/11, I started to feel like betrayed by this comic who was like, I'm only going to joke about one side. And it was just like, what the fuck? What? That's not honest in any way. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Anyway, but I just, so I held that resentment. And then I worked with him maybe 3 years ago, maybe 2 years, right? And me and another comic, a friend of mine, were like, I was just opening for him in a theater, and I just expected to hate him. You know what I mean? Like, and I had my thing, and then he walked into the green room, my green room, because he had his own, and he was the nicest person I've ever met. Like, me and the other guy were sitting there, and it took about 30 seconds before we were both like slack, like, oh my God, I want to be this guy's friend. Uh-huh. He was so fucking cool. And then I did my set, and I was who I am, but I obviously didn't go because his crowd is conservative. I'm not an idiot. So, and I came off, and he literally stopped me and talked to me for like, it seemed like way too long for a guy getting ready to go up, you know? and was just over the top complimentary, just a great dude. And I mean, and then I watched his set and same kind of thing. I realized, oh, he's just a comedian. He's most of it I was laughing at, right? And it's like, oh, he does what I do, but he just does sort of the opposite side of that.
Yeah,
where he's funny down the middle of the road, and then he has his point of view stuff. But like when he started talking about climate change, and now it's all that shit is fake, and so like stuff like that where I'm just like, you fucking know that you're lying. You know you're wrong about this. You're too smart to not know this. But you're that kind of stuff, like pisses me off, and I can't laugh. But I was really shocked by how much I liked him.
I mean, he's a super talented guy, and he knows how to play, you know, the game. Like, he can come across as very charming and very other oriented, and
right,
you know, I would never say anything bad about him as a comic. I think he blew me away, like so verbally fluid and just facile with language and all that stuff. But the guys that have known him for a long time would say that something slipped, like there was a disc that slipped in his brain somewhere along the way, because it just comes out of nowhere.
To me, you can't be on that. Yeah. To me, you can't be on that side. You can't.
You can't do comedy. Especially now. The master can't do comedy to the slaves, you know?
Right.
Comedy's, you can't punch down in comedy. It's like, yes. Hey, I got a good one for you. It's like, I don't want to hear it.
We need more money for the rich. Wait a minute, that's not funny.
Wait a minute, who? Anyway,
you know, when they say the rich are fucking the poor, they always say it like it sounds consensual. You know what I mean? It's not.
No, it wouldn't be any fun at that point. I mean, you know, what's the fun in consensual sex when you have $1 billion? So tell me a little bit about just sort of, you know, one of the things, again, I've always admired about you is that you go out and do stand up about issues, you know, at sort of regular comedy clubs, regular people. So talk about that a little bit. Like, I'm sure you've seen the evolution of crowds being so triggerable and now having permission, giving themselves permission to speak out loud their thoughts that resist your, at least your innuendo of your politics even.
Yes. It's taken me a lot of time, but somehow over the years I've figured out how to walk the line to where I'll have people that are like, dude, I don't agree with the thing you just said up there, but you fucking made me laugh, you know, like, so that kind of stuff makes me laugh. It also makes me feel like, well, maybe I'm not being hard enough at you, you know?
Right. Right. Yeah.
But yes, there's a lot more. I feel like comedy's going to be that, like that in the future, like as we move on, like there, it's going to be more like less of the sort of wall between you where you do your set, they listen and laugh, and we expect as such from them, you know. I feel like now it's going to be a little more tell your jokes, be ready to have some interaction with people that necessarily don't agree with you, you know, and then get into the next thing, you know. I might be wrong, but that's how I feel.
Weird. I mean, like, in sort of theoretical terms, kind of what's happened is that the public space has been renegotiated. So for a long time, the audience was instructed, you know, by implicit rule, you sit there and you listen. And if you get super drunk, sometimes they would yell shit, right? Because they couldn't remember the rule.
Right.
The general public rules have changed because of Trump, and because even before that, as sort of that started to break down, that the public has taken more power of like, no, I have the right to be in dialogue with you, not to just sit here and experience your monologue.
Right. Like, right.
And I don't know resurrect if it's just, that old rules or, yeah, you know,
I don't even know if it's just Trump, you know, those people were the first that I really started about, you know, 4 years ago, 4.5, 5 years ago to start to notice in the crowd, they were fine with being vocally wrong, like loudly wrong and acting like they weren't, you know what I mean, or whatever. So that was a little like jarring, like what, right. Like but I don't know if it's just him. I think it's also social media, because we're used to now voicing our opinions.
Sure.
Just we see somebody's opinion and we fucking blurt out our opinion, you know what I mean? I'm like, and it's me too, you know what I mean? I'm like autocorrect for when I hear stupid shit from people, you know what I mean? I'm like, I gotta I'm walking guy. I remember like right before this happened, I was walking through a Starbucks and I heard a guy go, you know, I do things unorthodoxly. And I was like, he means wrong. He doesn't wrong. Like, And then I realized, oh, he's in a job interview and I'm just blurting out what comes to mind as I walk by, you know?
You had a great bit, I remember, about politics, about them talking about the next guy coming up, like as a job interview.
Oh, yes. You know, it's like, it's funny you say that, because that is like the thing we were just talking about. Like, I was using that 3 weeks ago, because it's even worse now, which is right. that the campaigns, it's the one form of advertising that isn't beholden to any of our truth in advertising laws, right? So they just take advantage of that in campaign ads, right? So they talk shit about one another, they lie, they just, like, you know, and nonstop. It's like, dude, you're applying for a job as leader of the country. Tell me what you'll do. Don't just be talking smack about everybody else, right? The rest of us can't do that at our job interviews. They can't call you in from a lobby full of people like, have a seat, Mr. Simmons. What makes you the most qualified person for this position? You know what? I don't really want to go into that right now, but I can tell you this. Cantrell in the lobby picks his nose. All right. I watched him do it. He didn't wash his hands. He came out of the bathroom. He farts in elevators. He's a public martyr. I think he performed an abortion in the parking lot. You don't want that guy working for you. Basically, that was the joke.
Yeah, that's great. I love that. You know, I think that is one of the geniuses of stand-up, right? It takes these big elevated things that we see on national scales and it mixes it down into the private, you know, the most mundane stuff that you can do. And when you transfer right. those things back and forth, you get so much perspective, you know, both directions. And
right.
even
right.
the stuff, like, everybody's, you see it on social media all over the place right now, because Trump is wildly, you know, doing all these fake, you know, anything he can possibly litigate. And who else right. gets to do that? You know, there's
nobody.
No walk of life where you just litigate endlessly.
Yes. Yes. That's another, like, sometimes you lose a joke, you know what I mean? Cause you have the thing that makes that point like months before everybody else. And then it happens, and then right. it really happens in real life. And then it's like, all of a sudden that premise hits home to everybody. Right. Like, so for the last 8 months or so, I'd finally got excited, because I was working cruise ships, right? So we were talking about how to make my rhetoric work to America. You're right, driving around the country, even, you know, I didn't really start doing it until I got into listening to Bill Hicks in the late 90s. So I started in maybe 93-ish, you know, and then in the 98, 99 was when I started listening to him. And then I was like, oh, I got to be Hicks, you know? So it's like, I would have some of those confrontations with the crowd and blah, blah, blah. But somehow over time I'd figured out how to, like, that's another, like, the industry, oh, you can't do that stuff on television. For years, they're like, you can't do that's too, you know, blah, blah,
right.
blah.
Then you'd
know?
Have be Bill Maher and having a hit show for 30 years or whatever.
Right. They've always underestimated. I'd always thought that America wasn't as dumb as they think they are. And I think they prove I'm wrong, right? It's because you can see at least 50% of them are exactly what they're talking about. But the other 50%, I think, isn't. And so I've always thought there's a way to keep people in the room, you know, right. like I've had managers tell me, you know, before, like, you got to be able to, people got to know what your point of view is about a subject. Like, when they see a subject, they have to know, oh, I know how Tom would think about this. If, you know,
sure.
And my response to that was, that's awful. Like, I don't even know what I'm right. going to think about it. Hopefully I don't know. If I do, then I'm just another voice saying the fucking same thing as everybody, you know? So, you know, I feel like over time I figured out how to, I didn't want people walking out of the room. Like Bevins used to say about Stanhope, who I fucking love and admire and think is 1,000 times better. You know what I mean? But he would walk the room. And then, like Danny would say, once you walk half the room, of course, you have a church, right? Because now you have the real fans stayed and they have this sort of sure. extra connection to you because fuck those people for the yeah. left, right? And somehow it was in my head, oh, I want to do what a guy like Stanhope does or what a guy like Hicks did, but keep people in the room. You know what I mean? So that the seeds are dropped in there and maybe there is some change. You know, that was my...
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's part of the foundation of the stuff that I do. I'm doing a 3-webinar series right now of transforming MAGA, like using rhetorical principles and persuasion principles to actually go into their herd you know, that 73 million that just voted for Trump. And I'll show you techniques for pulling them out, rustling some of their cattle and getting them back over into, at least into the middle, hopefully over into the, you know, liberal or reasonable camp.
Have you tried it? Like gone to like a, like a, like a rally or a thing and just started talking to some people? And
well, that's part of what I do on the podcast is I have people from the right and the far right on the podcast and I convert them on the podcast.
Really?
Yeah.
Do they tend to, because of the techniques of rhetoric in the conversation, give the ground and then leave and sort of then discard all that and be like, oh, never mind with that. That was just a, like an aberration of me, you know what I mean? Or do they scientifically, or however the mind works, or do they start going right back to where they were, like an addict?
Well, there's a lot of, I mean, this is why I said like the tagline for a lot of this is complicated times require sophisticated techniques, and same thing, complicated people. What's been done to the far right, to this big herd of Americans, you know, it's a big pie. There's a lot of different slices in that community. There's some people that are, you know, come from hate groups and racist groups, but they're a minority still of that, you know, of that movement.
Of course.
And so, you know, every one of those little slices has to be converted differently. Like there is no cookie cutter for the pie slice where you just like, as soon as you say this, they're gone. You got them, you know? And so with conversion and real persuasion, you know, it requires a lot of commitment usually, because almost everybody has gotten to a certain political stance either over their lifetime, you know, they've been thinking about this for a long time. They come from a really strong background of like indoctrination, or right now they're going through the media mesmerizing machine of, you know, the right, the Fox News and the right, you know, the right-wing media, which is literally
the right-wing media is even being turned on. Like even them, they're being turned on, except for the Hannitys and the, you know what I mean?
A little bit, but it's not like they've already done their work. Like they've already shut down most of the rational neurons in people's minds. So once your rational neurons are gone, you know, reorganized towards just following whatever the leader says, then, you know, it's harder to go back in and get them, but you can do it, but you need technique.
Okay.
And like what you're talking about, keeping them in the room and dropping a few ideas in on them, you know, that's one of the things. I call it thorns. Like a lot of times I'll tell people, you know, I'll just going to put a thorn in your brain that you're not going to be able to forget. And it's going to ruin your belief just a little bit.
Oh, that's what I mean. That's a perfect way to describe it. So that was my sort of, in a way, goal. And then I started to figure out, oh, if I want to make fun of George Bush in a time when everybody's on his side, I have to sort of reel them in, and then it's too late. You know what I mean? So it's like you do a joke that's sort of positive about George. Like I like George Bush when he was governor of Texas, because I don't fucking live in Texas, but now that he's president, you know what I mean? And then that would get a laugh because they're, and then it's like, once you, I could make them laugh at the subject going in, then it opened the subject up that you can get away with punching him in the face for a little bit, you know?
Oh yeah. And if you watch like in the shock comics, like Stanhope or any of those guys, they smile all the time because you have to send signals that, hey, I like you. This is safe. You know, we're having fun here, even though I'm going for your jugular.
Right. Right. And to me, it's like, it gets hard. I don't know if it gets harder or easier if you're going to your crowd. Like I assume for Stanhope, it is easier in a way, but he has that thing that to me that he's a contrarian and he wants to fucking push you and get you. So then I noticed that when we were doing a Southern Liberals tour and liberals started showing up to it and it was like, oh, my people, they're really sensitive too, just about different things that I'm ready for, you know?
Yeah.
And then there's something about everybody agreeing with you that starts to sort of like, well, fuck that. I got to do something that's the energy I'm used to, you know, is creating something.
Sure.
So then it's like, now you, so I don't know if that gets harder to, if you're preaching to the choir, to still be able to smack the choir a little bit, you know what I mean? So I haven't really had to face that at length, But I just figured, and then I figured out in the last few years how to, where I started to be in, I introduce a premise like abortion, where I'm more honest about, like, I agree with both sides, and I point out the thing I agree with on this side and the thing I agree with on that side, and then do the joke, you know. And then next thing you know, again, they're laughing and they're in, and then I can sort of reveal what my left's leaning sides, you know what I'm saying? And now, but they've already laughed and now they're in, you know what I mean? And then I've made them laugh a couple times and blah, blah, blah. And then I'm out again, you know, and then I'm into the next thing. Now I'm talking about guns, and there's, so along the line, I'm going to make you laugh, even if you disagree with me. So that's sort of been my style. And then, so I'd figured it out with the Trump thing, 'cause I was really struggling. Like, it really pissed me off that I can write tons of jokes that work great on Facebook or two people that agree with me about him, but to get up in front of a crowd, even if there's only a third of the people are Trump supporters, they immediately hate you and will not laugh anymore. You know, like, right. I had in Myrtle Beach, I had like a row of like 75 to 80 year old, like one night it was like 65 to 80, and they're sitting there and they're like six of them, and they're laughing at everything. I'm talking about being a little league coach, just whatever I'm talking about. I'm killing with them. And then I did one Trump joke, and I swear I have an 80 year old woman like, fuck you, I'm out of here, right? And the whole table gets up and leaves. It's one joke, you know? So anyway, so I figured out I had figured out an angle in right before all this happened that was, I love it. I love that he keeps winning despite all the facts and evidence and blah, blah, blah. And I'm not even into politics, but I'm a sports fan, right? So I'm going to take the Trump fan logic as a sports fan, right? I'm a Falcons fan, baby. You know what I'm saying? They're the best team in the NFL ever since they beat the Patriots 28-3 in that Super Bowl, man. It's been smooth sailing. They are one of the best franchises in NFL history. They're going for their fifth Super Bowl this year in a row. You know what I'm saying? Some people look at the Kansas City's record and San Francisco's record, and they think they're doing good, but that's just fake ESPN news, right? So that was making Trump supporters and non-Trump supporters laugh, because the premise is so clear and so goofy, and everybody knows the Falcons suck and that they lost big, you know what I mean? So I would overhype and exaggerate it. And now that's sort of, you can't miss that joke. Everybody's doing that joke now that the election is over, you know? And it's funny, I was thinking back through, I used to do a joke, sorry to keep jumping from subjects, but I used to do a Slobodan Milosevic joke. Remember when he wouldn't leave after he lost the election?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he wouldn't leave, like, and it was another one of those, you can't do that at your job, right? They can't be like, you're fired. And you're like, you know what, I kind of like it here, I'll see you tomorrow. You know, I mean, you can't. And
that is the cool thing about, again, that's why, you know, to me, the art of stand-up, especially if you give a stand-up an audience to think about and you give them a topic to think about, they will eventually go through enough technique that they can find a way to make that audience okay with that joke, right? With that topic, because that's kind of the art of it. There's so many different avenues in. Like, I do a thing I was working on. I've sort of turned to doing one person shows instead of stand-up bits, like just theme out the whole thing and then write as much as I can, you know, within that thematic. So I wanted to do a policy.
You know who does that a great job at that is another guy that does a great job at that is Stuart Huff. I don't know if you know Stuart. He's a friend of mine. Sometimes I'm like a sidekick on his podcast, and he does that. Like, the first time I saw him do it, it really floored me. Like, he was doing this show called God Hates Anne, where he starts off with the question of, how does a human mind close? How do we go from being like a baby filled with wonderment to a guy standing there going, Jesus doesn't believe in transgender people. Like, what, how do you, that happen? Right.
Right.
And then he answers that question through like showing how humans fight thought and advancement and ideas all through history, you know? And he does it from like the beginning of record to present time. And he does it all funny and odd stories that you don't really know. And it was just fabulous. And at the end, it's the first time I've really noticed like, crowd members, they were genuinely moved, like in a way that you don't really see crowd members do. And I think one man shows have that ability to do, because like you said, it's sort of a funny TED talk or a funny one man play-ish thing. It's so interesting. I've never been able to really master that because I'm all over the place with like, here's a cliche joke and here's a joke about your mama and here's a joke about the Federal Reserve and what's that? You know what I mean? Like, that's how I am.
Yeah. I think that's most stand up, but I think it's really just finding a through line that ties your bits together, you know?
Right.
But like with politics, like I'm not political either. I'm now, you know, trying to turn this into, you know, a brand and a career and a business because I do rhetoric. And so to me, like I sit like a floating genie in between the two sides. And I tell people like, I don't care if you're conservative. I'm not super concerned if you're far right. I've seen some problems with the far right just sort of in the democratic process. And I don't care if you're liberal or far left liberal. I sort of sit in the middle and watch how everybody's talking like a referee of, hey, you're talking wrong. And that, right. that type of talk is going to destroy a democracy. Like you can't talk like the far right and have a democracy. Like it's
can you talk like we're doing like on the left? Can you talk like say I'm doing on the left, which is to almost talk down and to mock, like openly mock? I don't feel like I'm changing a lot of minds either.
Well,
by being like, you know, like, fuck you, you idiot. You know what I mean? That's not
defensive and aggressive and non-consensual talk, you know, where you're not looking to create consensus is part of democracy. They bang at each other all the time. Where it becomes a problem is when you're banging each other, but it feels there's a little hint of threat in there and there's recrimination. And there's like, that's the problem with the far right. Even the Trumpers in comedy clubs is that they can disagree, but verbalizing it destroys the experience that's been constructed. Right. It may become a new experience. You may be able to do, you know, function within that and still get humor, but it destroys the original experience. And that's going to destroy democracy too. Like there's a huge list of unethical persuasion techniques that the far right has adopted, and they are incompatible with democracy. They're fine in a dictatorship or an authoritarian state or an anarchy.
Right.
But they don't fit with democracy.
Does rhetoric get used like a lot of things in cycles? You know what I mean? Like some of what they're doing now, is it similar to sort of the rhetoric that was used to say crush the populist movement, you know, where it was like the poor black and white and everybody working together to be like, wait a minute, we need to do something to work together and to have that benefits all of us here at the bottom. And then sort of the rhetoric came of that basically separated it, you know, by race and by, you know.
Yeah, you know, I essentially call this, you know, these are unending rhetoric wars, you know, and factions come up and they resurrect old rhetorics. Like this all really comes from Nixon, you know, the whole far right.
Law and order does.
You know,
law and order, the phrase law and order.
I mean, that's
order.
Word for word, but all the techniques,
yeah.
The slander, like Nixon was a slander machine. That was his thing.
Like, I didn't know that.
He would, that's how he got into politics, was with Joseph McCarthy. He was on the McCarthy Commission and calling everybody communist. And so he just brought those techniques forward into the presidency. And then the right has been plagued by those techniques ever since. And Trump is the greatest slanderer of all time. You know?
Yeah.
He's not called out on any of his slander, and he slanders everybody.
What do you mean he's not called out? He has been called out nonstop by
just by the media. Yeah. That's nothing. Being called out by the media is totally ineffectual.
Right. The interesting thing to me about his stuff is like, you know, 15 years ago and up till around him, I was always sort of, you know, I've always thought this sort of labeling the media as the liberal media is also a bunch of bullshit rhetoric. That's just like, you keep saying it over and over and now people believe it.
Sure.
And you can't really have a liberal media. If nobody even knows who, if you've never seen Howard Zinn or Naomi Klein or fucking Noam Chomsky, really, those would be household names if it was liberal media. And it's, to me, it's always been like, well, here's the four corporations that own all of media. They're at the top of that. They don't have a liberal agenda. That's crazy talk. You know what I mean? But obviously there's a lot of liberals in media, but at the top and those kind of decisions. So I don't really know what my point was, but
so there are tons of techniques for that stuff. But what stand-up does, again, brilliantly, without ever knowing really what it's doing, is it feels its way to solutions for these things. So like when I do a political
solution to get a joke, you have the solution is the joke of the punchline.
Well, that's how you earn. That's how you earn the right to talk, is because you found a creative solution that nobody else has thought about yet. And that's pleasurable to the audience.
Right.
And you go out and just create those all day long.
So do you, knowing these techniques as a comedy audience member, do you get a little like, I'm not going there? Cause that's not, he skipped a step. Like he didn't really prove that point, or he just made us laugh at this thing, but that's a goofy idea. That wouldn't work. Cause blah, 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 blah. Do you break those things down, or do you just,
oh, do you mean like dragging comedy ideas over into reality about whether it actually work?
Yeah. Well, when you're watching it, you know what I mean? If you're like, meh, like so, there's a thing that's sort of not, there's a fallacy in the point that they're making. And even though it works because of that, you don't laugh at the joke. You know what I mean?
I separate my brain into rhetorical analysis and enjoying comedy. Like if it's good comedy, like I can enjoy, you know, even Dennis Miller and, you know, some of the other guys that kind of work the right a little bit. I don't care what genre that you're in, as long as you've got your act together for knowing how to write the jokes and deliver them, I can appreciate it. But it's when you find guys like, you know, that find a really interesting, and Stanhope is awesome at this. Stanhope, the way Stanhope earns his right to talk about this is he intellectualizes everything. And then he goes to the core of it and gets raunchy and everything else, you know, but he's a very artistic writer and he's a strong thinker. And so when you bring that to the audience, you're like, hey, I'm just trying to figure this out. Then they're like, okay, yeah.
Oh yeah. Cause they're not saying, hey, this is how it is. And you're dumb if you don't think that. He's like, here's my process and why I'm here.
Yeah. You know? I mean, there's a lot of ways of earning, you know, earning permission from the audience to talk about this stuff. And standups, they all put it into the premises, into the setups. You know, like if you've suffered from whatever issue you're talking about, then you've earned the right to talk about it. Right? If you have good intentions, you have the right to talk about it. It's like, I'm just trying to figure this out, trying to, you know, get a sense of what, like you said, with your sports, you know, I just appreciate it as a sports fan. You know, you've added a new dimension, so it gives you permission.
Right. So when you're doing this is your what number of one man show are you on? Is this like
Well, the first one I wrote was about losing, you know, 125 pounds. So
yeah, you did like a fitness one, right? Or a diet?
It was
one.
Just weight loss. It was just like it's now called Escaping the American Fat Trap.
Right. You know?
Because there's almost no escaping it. You know, it's crazy. And then I did one about Revenge of the Marriage Counselor's Ex-Husband, which is because I was married to a marriage counselor for 10 years.
Oh, wow.
And that
That's
one,
great.
That one is like, I had to listen to her therapeutic and, you know, psychotherapy explanations for everything for 10 years. It's time to listen to comedy explaining the same stuff.
And this, I'm sure this one was a little more from your side.
Oh, completely. Like this is, totally revenge of my side. It's a comedy versus therapy smackdown.
Yeah. It's funny. One of my newer jokes is, and I have to figure out a way to make this work because I say me and my wife have been having problems. Right. So I started seeing a therapist, right. I met her in Cleveland. Oh, she's beautiful. We play a lot of doctor client privilege. So I think it's hilarious. I love plays on words and stuff
nice.
That. You know,
it's
what I mean?
A good bait and switch.
People get defensive of your imaginary or what they know is your wife. You know what I mean? And you're like, oh, I'm fucking around with my wife.
That's funny. There's a comic in LA that I worked with for a while, and he got his wife caught him in an affair, and they stayed together. And he wanted to talk about it on stage about being the bad guy. And he wasn't an artful enough comic to get away with it, but it had such energy in that bit. Like because I tried to help him write it. And I was like, just start by saying, so I cheated on my wife and just watch the split, you know? And just,
it's okay. Okay. It's okay. We're still together.
Huh?
Yes.
Yeah. It's okay. We're still together. But you know, you get that kind of
energy. Did he try it that way?
I don't think he ever did. I watched him do it a couple of times. And again, he didn't have the, like, if you're going to do that stuff, your jokes better be really good. Right?
Dude, what is it about the guys you write for sometimes that just don't do the, they won't do the work to do the jokes? Like the one, you know, like who was the other person you wrote for? The guy who has the television show, his second television show right now. Was it you that wrote for him for a while? Yeah.
Billy Gardell?
And yeah. You'd write stuff for him and it did it just not fit him, or he just,
you know, comedians.
Did he get around to doing it, or was it all just he wanted to write the jokes himself? I don't understand. Like, I remember you telling me, I'm writing jokes and he's not even trying them.
you know, comics, like some comics, the way that they work through psychologically their material, it's too close to them. And I think with Billy, you know, he's done the same show for a long time and it works and he knows it and he wrote it. And so he's more comfortable inside those jokes. And so eventually he would just shave more and more of the new stuff out of the show, you know? And you know, every comic I wrote for, different psychological game, every single one of them.
Who would use like the most stuff you wrote sort of as is, and who would you do? And like, you'd watch him do the material and it'd be like, oh wow, that's so much. Cause normally when you watch somebody do a bit you gave them, you're proud and you want to tell everybody, I wrote that bit, right? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Or I wrote that tag but they never do it. Not that they never, but very rarely do you go, oh, they're doing it better than I would have done it. You know what I mean? Like, so did you watch anybody that you were like, holy, like they took what you did to another level that you were just like, oh wow.
Well, I've written for Schubert forever, you know, And
yes,
once Jimmy gets,
yes, there's,
once he gets going,
yeah,
it's just feeding him lines, and the more tags and the more veers and the more sharp, you know, he just won't stop. It's amazing. You know?
Yeah, he is. He's a good example of that. He's a good example, like, you know, or where you can go, God, yes. Like, you know, you just saying his name, I was like, oh yeah. Like every bit I have would be funnier coming out of Jimmy Schubert's mouth.
Yeah. And it's just super fun to write.
He does the energy. Yeah.
Super fun. Yeah. But they are, their stage talent, you know, is at least equal to the jokes and probably beyond the jokes. So that's when it's sweet, man. When you get somebody like that delivering the jokes.
Yeah.
So tell me a little about the Southern Liberals tour, because I always found that really interesting. Tell people a little about the history of that and what that was.
We, you know, to be honest, this kid out of Wilmington, his comic, Cliff Cash, right, who I knew a little. He was one of those guys who sends you a video of him, like, you know, you don't know him, but you're like, oh yeah, it's nice to meet you. Good job. Da, da, da. Next thing you know, you get an email with a 45 minute video that he wants you to watch of him filmed on one camera in the back of his home club. And it's just you know what I mean? And it's like, dude, I don't even want to watch 7 minutes. I'm not going to watch. And then it's like, hey, did you watch? You know, so he was Mr. Super excited. Anyway, he had the idea to do a tour, with me and Stuart Huff and him. And I immediately was like, well, first of all, why? You're picking two guys who between us don't draw, or good comics, but we're both terrible at everything besides comedy that in the comedy business, you know.
That's funny.
And he was like, well, I want to build this tour with us three and Southern comics, blah, blah, blah. And I just was sure it wouldn't work. And then, so I was like, yep, but I'm not doing any promo, or I'm just not, you know. And then we started doing it, and people would show up. You know, he worked hard at getting us on some like NPR interviews and stuff like that.
Nice. Yeah.
And the idea, and somehow we hit on this idea of, you know, like, so we called it Sick of Stupid, and me and him and Stuart went out and started doing this show. And it was just advertising to, like, we're liberal Southerners, you know? And I was surprised by how many people would show up to those shows just because of that. Right. And then we sort of hit on the idea of like, well, dude, there's even in a state like Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, where they get their asses kicked every year, except for this year, there's still 48% of the people that are that are like a meathead in a state full of Archie Bunkers, you know what I mean? And but they're there and they're just not appealed to.
Right.
And he was right. And so we started doing this thing, and then we had, you know, a little, there was some personality conflicts and some this and that. And then the, and then about maybe 3 or 4 months after we started doing it, the, it's funny because Stuart and I had been talking about other comics that were also Southern liberal, and then Trey Crowder had that video go viral from his back porch. And then they started the Well Read tour. Right. So they just jumped past us with basically the same idea, you know, here's a tour of Southern liberals. And it's, as you see, there's a shitload of them, you know?
Yeah. I think any of those things that get niched out like that, it gives people a way to actually understand what they're buying. Cause nobody ever understands what they're buying with stand up. You never know what you're going to get when you walk in the door.
Yeah. It was fun. You know, it was fun because it was like like I said, it was weird to be in front of, especially for Stuart and I in the beginning of it, especially, it was like, it was weird to be in front of audiences that agreed with us. So there was a weird,
adjustment you had to make to like, anymore, right? They're like,
yeah. And then you'd be like, oh wait, they're like offended almost in a different way. Like they're like, they get offended at like you being mean to somebody or right. to like, you know, or questioning their thing. It was interesting. It was fun, you know, cause you could really crank, but the jokes would get laughs in different places. It was almost like doing, not quite, but it was almost like doing an all black audience where it takes a few shows before you start to realize, oh, the beats need to change. A little bit of the verbiage needs to change. And your energy, adjust your energy a little bit here and there too, that you have to make those adjustments. Sure. Depending on which crowd you're in front of, you know?
Well, again, nobody really knows that if you're not like a long time stand up where you've gone out and, you know, there are 100 dials that you have to turn, micro dials to get the stuff to work, you know?
Right.
And if you do it wrong, that joke dies. And suddenly you realize like, oh, I don't have to pad this joke with so much, you know, fluff or around it, because they don't want all that. They want, you know, the hardcore get to it. And
I always came away from doing a week at Uptown, which was a black club in Atlanta. I always came away from there tighter and knowing which jokes were not really crisp, you know, that people were letting me get away with. I saw, you know?
Yeah. All the cultures here are different, right? It's really interesting to do that going across. The worst gig set I ever did was for, it was at the Hollywood Improv, and there were, they had bussed in, Japanese teenagers who were on tour of America, you know, and there's just one of the things that they sold on their tour was they brought in 200 Japanese teenagers and fed them cake and milk and stuff like that. And, you know, how are you going to do stand up? It wasn't even English first language. Talk about not hearing the beats or anything else. Like what?
Right. Any sort of cultural reference or
nothing
or a cliche, because they don't get, you know, and so many jokes are written on wordplay and
forget all
making
of
a twist. Ugh.
Well, that's really interesting. The whole like I said to me, like you you know, using the working in the South so much and bringing, you know, what has become hyperactivated now liberal ideas. Like the far right and that has taken basically over the Republican Party has picked out a whole litany of terms and positions that as soon as they hear them, they're encouraged to, it's like they're booby trapped, right?
Right, right.
They go off.
Yes.
So do you ever call yourself a liberal in your show or?
Not really. I think it's obvious pretty, you know, but I also, like I said, I'll walk the line, and I don't so much when it's like my show and I'm, you know what I mean? And it's like, I'm doing my show somewhere in a club, but I was, to be honest, I really started to enjoy working the ships. You know what I mean? It felt like, because the comedy clubs for me, at least, cause I'm not a draw, were you go in there and that's the week people are come to the show. Because there's a show, you know?
Right.
So it was a lot of sort of that sort of feeling like a failure before you hit the stage for 10 years, you know, but on the comedy clubs on these ships on, on Norwegian and stuff. They're like, they're freestanding comedy clubs, and they're packing in there to see them, you know? So it was fun to be a comedian again, you know what I mean? Right. So it's like, and the money's great, and it's, you know what I mean? And it really forced me to get to work, you know? Cause it's like you're doing 8 shows in a week, you know what I'm saying? And it's different crowds, but it's the same crowds. And then you got to do a different show here. You got to do one clean where there'll be kids in the crowd, you know what I mean? So it really sort of forced me to really work and build a bunch of different sets but once people start to laugh, like I keep saying, they'll let me get away with stuff. Like I could do guns. I could do, sometimes I would even do, like, if the crowds really liked me and they were coming back, I'd even do the abortion chunk or whatever. But mostly it was make them laugh, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, little jabs here and there, you know, punch and move, you know? but I was really digging doing it, but you're right. I'd get calls in my room sometimes from the head entertainment person. They're like, we just had to call you and tell you, the guy and some people from the you know, some of the gold members or whatever they are, were complaining about you doing a joke about Trump. They said, you know, and one of them specifically was just when I said, there was a bunch of Canadians in the crowd. And I was like, oh, you guys once burned down the White House, right? You guys loved it. They're like, yeah. And I'm like, can you do it again? Yeah, I'll even help you, you know, and a big laugh. And then one guy's like, you know, you're a cunt. Like, say exactly what you're talking about. Getting up, yelling, leaving. Now I got to go and go try to get the guy fired. I got to blah, 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 you know?
Right, right.
And so they got to call me and tell me, look, you know, and I'll tell the joke that I told them, and they'll either be like, that's okay. Just do that. It's fine. That guy's an idiot. Or they'd be, all right, just so you know, you're going to get some complaints on that, you know? So you adjust, you know? And so to be honest, I was mostly avoiding Trump unless I could get into it. And then I wrote that joke about the 85-year-old lady going, fuck you. So then I had a couple jokes there. And then I had an old joke about Hillary Clinton and how if when Bill Clinton was cheating, you know, so I just turned that into Trump is cheating. You know, it's pretty lazy, but it's, you know,
hey,
if that would
have
been my wife, she would have been spread all over the White House lawn. You know what I mean? And so there's jokes that are sort of universal about the topic and not the man himself.
Right.
You know, that allow you to do a couple about him and then get out and boom, you know? So like I say, I figured out how to sort of dance and move. And I always wanted to be able to do it, but I hate to talk shit about people because I'm a fan of Will Durst and guys like that. But I worked with Will Durst years ago too, and I watched him, and he's big on, I'm going to be in the middle. And I would watch him and just be like, man, well, you're not on any side.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's hard to make me care. You know, it's fine. You wrote a joke about them, but I know you don't believe that joke where you're making fun of it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I kind
so
of,
it felt,
yeah, I remember
it
that.
Felt
I think,
flat. It felt flat instead of, which comedy to me, it's got to be filled with that sort of like desire to create change.
You sure.
Know, that's what's exciting to me about some. About
so let me give you a scenario that would never happen, but you get a phone call and they're like, hey, we want you to open for the next Trump rally. Do 15 in front of Trump. What would you do?
12. No, I mean,
a tight 12. I can do 12 and then I'm out.
No,
you
know
what? What would you say to these people?
Depending on how much money they paid me, I would do it. You know what I mean? But I mean, I can make them laugh. I can, like, all I gotta do is 15. I can make any group of people laugh in 15 minutes. You know what I'm saying? Like, that was always another thing. I want to be able to walk into any situation and be able to get laughs.
Well,
and I think,
you know,
I
when I was writing,
I would do family stuff. I would do stuff about my family. I would
No. You
got to
do politics. Got to do politics.
I got to do politics. I would do. I would do guns because I got enough gun stuff. I would do. I would do the abortion stuff just because I think it. Again, it. You have to be. You basically have to. I've written it in a way where you basically have to be, fuck you, I'm not thinking. you have to embrace, like, cause I'm like, I agree with both sides. Don't you? I mean, it's like this and this and that. And, but you know, it's, I agree with the left that it's, you know, or I, you know, I, that it's too important an issue to let the government decide for them. And I agree with the right that that's a life. And at some point you gotta, you protect it. You can't just be, you know, get rid of what, just cause it's inconvenient for you. I mean, what if you don't like old people? You can't be like, you know, grandma, I'm just too old to have a grand, you know, it's, I can't even do the joke off the top of my head, but it's basically like that, you know, like,
you know, yeah, what that, if you middle, like that middle ground like, earned you the right, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Talk about so both sides here. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then you sort of do, and then you're, so I would do that. I would do the Federal Reserve stuff because that's one of those subjects. It's about money. And like, here's money. Money is our God. Capitalism, blah blah blah. And then it gets into
80% of the country doesn't know there's a Federal Reserve, so you'd be
right.
Fine.
And they don't know that it's made up, and that there's people that own it. So that some of that stuff is interesting. And then it's like, what? Blah, blah, blah. And then there's enough twists, and then I'm yelling at the banks in like a rant. I'm screaming at the banks. So people on both sides like that. The only time that hasn't reached both sides is after Occupy Wall Street, when the media rhetoric machine cranked up to be like, Occupy Wall Street, they're anti-capitalist. So I started running into a thing at that time where that joke started causing some division instead of, you know, people that are just being like, I don't give a fuck about this. Like my wife says, Tom, nobody cares. Nobody came to the comedy club to see the economy comic. Let's go see the economy comic, Tom. He's hilarious, baby.
Ah, that'd be great, man. I think if you can inhabit those spaces, love it.
Yeah. I would do religion. I did a what's the streaming service that's the Christian streaming service? There's like a Netflix, but for anyway, I did a comedy thing on it one time. I did a recording for one, and I did a lot of my version of Jesus material, which is he says, love everybody. Have you met everybody? You know what I mean? It's like that kind of love your neighbor as thyself. I don't think my neighbor wants me touching him that way. You know what I mean? It was like nonviolence and love and don't hit your kids and stuff like that. And they did not love it. You know what I mean?
Cause there's not a lot of space. There's not a lot of space in that religious, you know, community, like the 0.5% that they can laugh at. Right. There's not a lot of space. It's a thin audience.
All it takes is them to have read it a little bit to me, because I'm not going out on limbs. You know, to me, I've always said things like, hey, racism is wrong. Let's make fun of people that are racist. Hey, the answer is love, and don't like beat your kids and shit like that. You know what I mean? Like those are not huge stances.
But that's you're thinking. What are you doing thinking your way through things? That's not a thinking community. I grew up Catholic in the South, and it's not even just that, discussing things. It's not a discussing culture.
I was just going to say, even being Catholic in the South, they're like, boy, get out of here. What is that?
What?
Damn Catholics. My father-in-law had that thing. He'd say something about it's funny because I remember 5 or 6 years ago, he said something about the Catholics, and I was just like, what? Like,
right. Like that was a prejudice. Like, where did, right. Like Biden's Catholic. Like when Kennedy ran, you know, in the early 60s, that was the thing. Like, oh, he's Catholic. We can't, you know, that was the big stain thing for him, was that we never had a Catholic president.
Why is that?
What
was that? Is it because they think they'll choose the Pope over the country?
Well, that there's all that. Like Catholicism was considered a cult, and you know, it wasn't mainstream as, you know, the other religious denominations, and so it was just it was the poor kid that they picked on. The Catholics took anybody. It was kind of the, you know, it was the rabble of Christianity.
I'm the opposite. I didn't even know that. I always thought of Catholicism as sort of the mainframe, and then all the Protestants sort of came off of it. Like they were the smaller, brothers.
Yeah, different areas of the world, that's true. But like, I would say, you know, in the South, like where I was from, like Catholics, Baptists were the biggest, you know, order. And like my grandparents on my mom's side were Baptists and almost evangelical, except they were too lazy to go to church. And so then my dad's side was Catholic. And so I was kind of raised, you know, moving back and forth between them a little bit. But you know, the Catholics came from different, typically different, you know, Eastern Bloc countries and stuff like that. So there was a lot of tension between those Protestant and Catholic religions back then. But Biden's Catholic and barely even got mentioned.
Yeah, I don't remember it even being mentioned, to be honest.
Yeah, just barely. They, you talk about him at church, but they don't like throw it in there.
Dude,
very
he's
often.
Already gone to church more times as president-elect than Trump did in his life.
Trump
and he gets the Christian vote
in his heart.
Okay, that's true. I forgot. It's amazing to me.
That's why he looks like he picked up a little. He's got it strapped around his stomach.
It's amazing to me that he is considered by the religious and the Christians as godly, and like Obama was sort of the piece of shit, you know, anti-Christian. Like, that doesn't even make sense. Like, even if Barack was a Muslim, which he's not, he's still more Christian than Donald Trump, just in his actions and ideals.
This is one of the things I do, like, again, with rhetoric. It's the beauty of rhetoric is that it looks at all forms of influence. So it doesn't care whether it's logic or it's emotion or it's, you know, indoctrination or whatever. It'll look at it, try to understand it, and try to figure out how to counteract it. So religion is not, it's not an intellectual game. It's literally the book has been written, hear the lessons, memorize them and the stories, and then just apply that. Like, you don't
but they're
ask
not
people
applying
to make
that
a decision. Huh?
But they're not applying that. Like the big box churches now, or the prosperity preacher types. And they're literally like, the reason Joel Osteen has to write so many books is because, like, the hardest part of his ministry is making sure people don't fucking read their books, because what he preaches is absolutely the opposite of it. You know what I mean? Greed is good. It's greed is good, and money is, and you don't have enough because you don't pray enough. And
again,
it's exactly
I wanted you talk about this before we get off. Like, so religion is not a thinking space. Okay. And for thinkers, that's always hard to realize. Most people that are in an indoctrination community, it's literally about listening to the stories, pull a little fragment here and there, but it's not an analysis space. Even when it does, it's
how
like,
I don't understand how you can as a human being make a choice about God, like what God is going to be to you, right? And you're not going to look into that at all.
It's like
you're like
God in your heart, Tom,
but
not your head. Like, what is wrong with you?
But at least
all them thoughts will just confuse Jesus while he's trying to get to your heart.
Okay. That's one of those things where I've always sort of disagreed with maybe what you're saying. Cause I've always thought, no. When it comes to something like that, people have put some thought into that. They're not just picking a thing like a God and going like, you know, like Jimmy Dore used to say, wouldn't let my parents pick my pants. I'm going to have them pick my religion, you know, my God. And which I always thought was the perfect joke for describing that. But, you know, but
it's a repetition community. It's weird for rational people to go into those communities. And that's why I want you to talk about just a little bit, and we'll jump off here. I don't want to keep you too long.
Okay.
But like you the Pew thoughts, was that what it was?
Oh, Pew tweets.
Pew tweets.
Oh, yeah.
That was genius, dude. You should have kept riding that forever. That's a career maker to me. Like, yes, you'll be death threatened and probably murdered, but that was the most unique thing that I've seen a stand-up do, you know, to just that perspective out into a live setting and, you know, just do your thing. So talk about that a little bit. Tell people what it was. And I was fast. So, I used to read it all the time.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of really why I stopped, but what I started, how I started that was I was doing a podcast with some, a guy now who works a lot with, Reverend William Barber. I don't know if you know Reverend Barber. He's the Poor People's Movement.
Like, oh yeah, I know who that is. Sure.
Yeah. Oh, he's an incredible human being. You know what I mean? Picture Franklin Graham over here, and he's the exact opposite of him. And
he's an actual Christian, you're saying.
Yes. And anyway, I was doing a podcast with this guy and another guy called Bully the Bullies, and we were sort of like, it was sort of anti religion. Like, we're going to take them on because they're bullies and blah, blah, blah. And then he, this small town, North Carolina, he, one of the guys had a, had a, had a church that got mad at him because he, the guy, it was when gay marriage was coming up in North Carolina. So he was saying things like, it's going to be like a nuclear holocaust if you don't vote this down. And he's telling people this in his church. Sure. So he called him out on it, blah, blah, blah. And he asked me one to go to a service because he wanted to see if the guy was going to talk about him in the service. And I was like, I don't want to. And I ended up going and then just sitting there. And I'm like, okay, I hadn't been to church in a long time. So I was tweeting at the time. This is when I was like, oh, live tweeting is the thing. So I would kind of, I started tweeting and it was like, oh, it kind of connected where I noticed I started get people liking and, you know, and I was writing jokes and stuff. And so then I started, then I went the next week and did it again at another church. And then the, a thing happened maybe an hour from my house where there was a preacher that was on, that had been on CNN. Cause he, to his service, to an amening cheering service, he said, I've been thinking about this and here's what I've come up with. We need to take all the lesbians and put them in a fence and then take all the gays and put them in a fence and then they'll all die. Cause they can't breed. Right. And it was like a lot of amens. It was fucking crazy. Right. So I, and so it was in the news and blah, blah, blah. So I went to the church the next week. So I drove to that church and I was like, all right, I'm going to go in and live tweet that service. And I got there and there was like police with dogs and stuff that were there. And I ended up getting there like an hour early and I ended up sitting in the back of the church and immediately people recognized that I wasn't supposed to be there. Right. So like I went in the bathroom and a guy comes in and sort of starts sort of giving me a break. Like, what are you, who are you? And I'm like, I'm looking and I'm just going to different churches and trying to figure out, you know, and I'm taking notes and blah, blah, blah. And so they're all like, they have to be like, welcome and blah, blah, blah. So I sat in the back and they said a couple things to me, told me to get off my phone at one point. And I was like, you know, and then, and I didn't know why they had a right to tell me that. And then the service started and some people came in that were, they were sat right in front of me. And then they were singing the national anthem or the Star Spangled or God Bless America or something, which to me immediately was like, wait a minute, you're in a church and you're worshiping a flag. Like, it's, yeah, yeah. Immediately you're fucking breaking a commandment. Right. And then they had some people that were catching the spirit, like, So I literally laughed out loud because the lady sort of, and so some guy turns around, that's it, you're gone. Cause they, and then like a, and then a cop comes over or something. And they, cause I guess they were paranoid because it was been in the news. The place was packed. Like other churches had canceled their services in order to show this pastor that they supported him.
Right. Sure.
So then they went to kick me out and they were like, what are you doing on your phone? And I was like, I'm live tweeting to shut-ins. So I told them.
Oh, beautiful. What a nice piece of improv. How do you beat that? Crowd work. Yes. Oh, nice.
And so they don't even know that they really knew what Twitter was, but anyway. So I sat in and listened on the speakers and then they even came up to me right beforehand and they were like, okay, the church is getting ready to let out. You might want to get out of here. You know, and I was like, okay. So I got out of there and later I saw the guy that had turned around and thrown me out on the news and he was a relative of the pastor's. He was like, and they show him at the front door, like lifting his shirt and he's got a gun in his thing, you know? So I was like, okay, I messed with the wrong guy. So I started going to every city I would in, I would go to a different church and I would always try to find like, what's the craziest church, you know? Sometimes I went to a Hindu temple once, which was really cool. So the idea was just to go to as many as I could and then I would listen to the service and sort of commentate on it and live tweet. And it was interesting to sit back there. At first I was really uncomfortable and felt like I was doing something heretical and blah, blah, blah. But eventually at first it's hard not to stand to do the Lord's Prayer with everybody, right, to do the song. Like, and it's interesting when you're not to sit and you can see the cultness of it. Right. You can hear the all in unison. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And the same formula, like you go in, there's a couple songs and they do like a prayer. Then they start passing the basket. They get their money up front, basically. And it's weird because while they're passing that, they do a big prayer where they pray for the take to be bountiful, basically. You know what I mean? And so they're everybody. And it's pretty universal across denominations. Yeah. They do the same sort of formula. So that's what I would do. And I would go to different ones. And so, you know, and inevitably, you know, it's hypocrisy is happening just from the sermon versus what's happening in the church, you know? So it was like that kind of stuff. So I'd be writing jokes as it happened. And I was surprised by how many jokes I could write every week, sitting in there, you know? And it wasn't always mocking or whatever. It was just sort of on the subjects. And then, you know, it started to feel after about 8 or 9 months, it started to feel like, okay, I'm doing the same. It's the same now.
Right.
And it also started to feel like, first of all, it's a pain in the ass getting up every Sunday to do it and to get to church.
Suffer for your art, man.
Yeah. My wife has told me many times over the years, you should start doing that again, you know, but I think what happened is I went to a couple churches and I was like, huh, this one's pretty good. And then I was like, I can't have that.
That's right. That indoctrination ritual, same thing over and over again, that burns a neurology into your brain.
Yes,
doesn't matter who you are. You start wanting to sing the songs, man. You're like, oh, this is a good version of this one. They sound good. Well, you should do, like, just take that stuff, like what I did. You've got plenty. I don't know what kind of notes you took on it, but just weave it into a 60 to 90 minute show, you know, give it a starting point and an end point, and then just have fun with it. You'd get tons of people who want to hear that. Like, I want to hear
again,
it.
I was surprised about, that was the only church I got thrown out of. Some of them were very welcoming. I was surprised how many of them sort of recognized that I wasn't one of them immediately, you know? Like, they could tell sort of at the door, like, oh, you're new? Like, how do you know that? Like,
yeah. No, you should do that. I don't know if it interests you enough to do it, but that's got a beautiful hook. That's the kind of hook that you could get on the media with it. You write a little book that goes with it, and you'd have a nice little product.
To be honest, like, a lot of those things I'll do like that, I end up giving up too soon. Like, I could did it for 9 months, and it's like, all right, this isn't, nobody's jumping on board really with this. It's just me doing it every month. You know what I mean?
My friends are laughing. You got to turn into a product, get it into the marketing, you know, trough, and off you go.
The funniest one I got was when I went to the Pentecostal church and they were dancing and singing in the aisles, and they had like, it was like old school, like hell and brimstone. Like, the guy was like, you need to get a stronger grip on Jesus. So when Satan comes knocking at your door, you're well prepared. And I was like, oh shit, Satan doesn't come knocking at my door. Christians come knocking at my door.
Yeah.
Is there anything I can grip to keep those motherfuckers away? You know what I mean? Like that.
That's great.
That was always
awesome, man. Well, this has been great, man. I love, I don't connect enough to stand-ups anymore. You know, like, I've been working sort of a marketing agency here in Austin for the last 5 years and doing stand-up and one-man shows and stuff and still writing on the side. But there's no substitute for just hanging out with, you know, hardcore stand-up and just.
Yeah, man. I appreciate the time, dude. I'm writing on a television show. So it's like, I get in a Zoom meeting all day and it's nothing like I've ever done. It's like, it makes me realize, holy shit, I wish I'd written 7 hours a day every day of my career. I'd have a private jet, because this is just, it's hard to write in that form versus the form I've been used to for 20 years, you know?
Yeah. Is it a sitcom or a talk show?
It is. It's going to be the Miss Pat show. I don't know if you know the comedian Miss Pat. She is hilarious and like nobody I've ever met in my life. And she has stories, like, she was raised in Atlanta in the hood and was like a crack dealer, and her mom was an alcoholic, and she had, you know, two kids by the time she was 14 by a 20 something year old man, you know, like, just
damn.
And now she lives in middle of the small town Indiana, all white place, just like hating it, wanting to move back to Atlanta. Her story literally is the fish out of water story, the woman overcomes crazy trauma in her life story, like every great story wrapped into one, and she's hilarious. So it's sort of a fun show to write. It's sort of going to be like a Black Roseanne meets All in the Family meets Jefferson. Like, it's some of the people
fun,
are really
that,
innovative. Yeah, it yeah, is. It is.
That sounds awesome.
It is.
Well,
so
cool.
Look for it. Miss Pat show on VT Plus.
Yeah. Always fun. Yeah. What do we talk? What, every
Anytime.
10 years now? Something like that.
Yes. I always learn stuff from you, and I always feel like I should be working hard and doing it differently when I talk to you.
No, not at all. I always listen to you and I'm like, oh, he's enjoying life more than I am. Look at that.
Yeah. Ignorance is bliss.
Hilarious. Yeah. All right, buddy. Well, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. This has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Tom Simmons, check him out. Go to TomSimmons.com.
But mostly just hit me up on Facebook or T Simmons Comedy on Instagram. I don't do Twitter. They actually banned me because I told the president he should put a gun in his mouth.
Huh.
Well, they didn't ban me. They just suspended me and I never went back because that's what it was turning into. You know? About 6 months ago, they emailed me back and were like, hey, we apologize. You were right all along. You should have done that. But those two sites, Facebook, I write almost every day on there, and Instagram. And I have a special on Drybar you can watch, which be what we're talking about. But if I was to perform for Trump's crowd, basically, it's to the Mormons, totally clean.
Oh, yeah. So yeah, definitely check that out. I like watching like Bent Washburn and all those guys on Drybar and, you know, just some great comics on there.
Oh, he's so good, man. He's so good. Yeah. He's all right, man. I really appreciate it.
My next guy to interview. So that'll be my headliner run. It'll be Tom Simmons and Bent. Got to get Kostaki on here. Yada, yada, yada. So.
Yeah. Get Danny. Kostaki's doing that thing like 50 toasts. That's pretty good. You should do that with him too on his.
Yeah. I'll hit Bevins up too at some point. So cool, man. Appreciate it. Dude. All right.
Yeah. Take care of yourself.
Yeah. You too.